From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll have reaction to the Boston Police Department's move to force 100 randomly selected officers to wear body cameras in September. Plus, on Martha's Vineyard, state police and the National Guard seized hundreds of marijuana plants from island residents' yards, but were the seizures legal?
Whether or not the owner of the plants has a card, it is still illegal to grow the marijuana outdoors.
Also today, raising African-American children in a largely white Massachusetts suburb. We'll talk with a Wellesley professor and mother about how challenging that can be. And
Jevy Stone of Team USA, Dr. Jevy Stone from Massachusetts, is in second at the moment and in medal contention.
From rowing on the Charles to medal contention in Rio, we'll have the latest from the Olympics next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've got two law and order stories to start with today. First, police body cameras. Boston police are beginning the process of notifying 100 officers who have been selected to wear body cameras for a six-month pilot program. Last month, Mayor Marty Walsh and Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans struck a deal with the city's largest police union to outfit officers with the cameras on a voluntary basis, but no volunteers stepped forward. So yesterday, Evans announced that 100 randomly selected officers will be forced to wear the body cams. Joining us now with the latest is WBUR Zeninjor Enwemeka. Zeninjor, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, Meghna.
So first of all, you were able to speak with the Boston Police Department today. What did they tell you?
Yeah, so the police department's position is that assigning the cameras isn't outside the agreement with the union. So I spoke with Lieutenant Mike McCarthy at BPD, and he says that the agreement is still being followed. And here's what else he had to say.
The agreement was that we would attempt to get volunteers. That didn't happen, so now the commissioner is going to assign officers.
Interesting. But of course, yesterday when Commissioner Evans said that he was going to force the 100 randomly selected officers to do so, he also said he anticipated some pushback, right?
Yes, he did. He did. He said we haven't, and again, you know, we haven't heard much from the unions yet at this point. Yes, again, Commissioner Evans did say he expected some pushback. So that's definitely something to follow in the coming weeks.
Okay, so we'll keep our eye on that. Now, does this decision on randomly selecting 100 officers changed the timeline for the rollout of the pilot program of the body cams?
So it changes it a little bit. So, I mean, the police department says that they expect the body camera program to begin in early September. But there are a couple steps that need to happen before that. So, you know, here's sort of a rundown. Here's what we know now in terms of the timeline. So starting today, officers are being notified that they will be assigned body cameras. Then those officers will have to be trained. So that training is expected to start next week. And is expected to last a couple weeks, and then the pilot program should be up and running in early September.
Okay. Now, as we talked about a little earlier, these 100 officers are being randomly selected. Are they being selected by the Boston Police Department itself, or are they getting some assistance in doing that?
So the Boston Police Department is getting assistance. So the 100 officers will be randomly selected by Northeastern Professor Anthony Braga, who heads the criminology department there. And so Commissioner Evans has said that, you know, the pilot program will include officers of all ages, races, a variety of different sections of the city, as well as different specialized units will make up those 100 officers.
And what has the commissioner said about what might happen if an officer who is selected refuses to wear the body cam?
Evans has said that officers who choose not to wear the cameras will be subject to disciplinary action.
Okay, interesting. And as you mentioned, we've reached out to the Boston Police Union at the center of this. this question, and we've yet to hear back from them. But that's WBUR's Zanindra and Wemeka giving us the latest on this move to force 100 police officers, randomly selected police officers, to participate in the six-month pilot body cam program starting in September. Zanindra, thank you so much for the update.
You're welcome, Meghna.
Okay, so let's dig a little bit deeper into this question of police body cams and how the pilot program is unfolding here in Boston. And helping us to do so is Carl Williams. He's a staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Carl.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, first of all, just reiterate to us what the ACLU's position is on body cams in Boston.
So in Massachusetts and also nationwide, the ACLU supports body-worn cameras on police officers because we feel it ensures accountability and transparency. And that's if it's done right, right? If there are certain policies and procedures put in place. One of the things we're very against is facial recognition, right? Because if the Boston police had 2,000 or 3,000 body cameras in the street and every one of them was scanning people's faces and saying, we know this person was here at this time, I think most of the public would be very worried about that.
Okay. So I'm really interested about the if it's done right part. I mean, facial recognition is one of those if it's done right questions. But do you think it's being done right that the BPD is now forced to is forcing 100 randomly selected officers to participate in the pilot program?
I think I'm going to actually say required instead of forced,
okay.
Right? Because you're not forced to do this radio show. It's just your job, right? And I think part of this is, you know, a police officer is required to wear a gun. They're required to wear a badge. The BPPA, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, could say, we're being forced to do this. This is 21st century policing, right? That's what it is. And I think that's what we're looking at right now. And there certainly is room for negotiation, I think, and the BPPA is using this as a little bit of a wedge.
Right. I mean, the Patrolman Association's president, Patrick Rose, has said, well, forcing or requiring officers to wear body cameras goes against the deal that the union reached with the department. I mean, if you could look into your crystal ball here a little bit, echoing what Commissioner Evans says yesterday, do you think that this is a case that could likely go to court?
It's hard to tell if this is some brinksmanship right now, and maybe there's something else they want. And one of the things I would look to in terms of what the rank and file, what the Patrolmen's Association wants, is this recently drafted letter that they said, which was about having machine guns, essentially they say long guns, but machine guns on the street and other more forms of armament. And I think that's sort of going in the opposite direction of what we're hearing in the country. It's also going in the opposite direction of what we're hearing in the state and people talking about police accountability and concerns about use of force.
Yeah. Do we know of any other cities, major American cities, where the rollout of a body cam, police body cam program, I mean, I was going to say has been as contentious, but I presume it's been contentious in a lot of places, but that the police department had to take this extraordinary step to even get a pilot program off the ground.
Yeah. One of the questions about that I have is if the Boston Police Department, if the brass, let's say, feels that they could require or force the officers to do it, then the interim step of saying, well, it's voluntary and we have to do this and we have to negotiate with the union, that seems like that process could have been abrogated. They could have just said, look, we're going to randomly select 100 people. And also that's what we were hearing on the street. People wanted there to be a wide selection of people, departments, and units that have police, that have body cameras, instead of selection, because selection, someone can just say, well, you know, I'm going to be a community service officer and go, you know, give out ice cream today. Why shouldn't I wear a camera?
Mm-hmm. So given that, is there the possibility that the way this is unfolding, at least over the period of the pilot program or the 6 months, we might actually get a truer representation of the experiences that the officers and community members are having on the street if we have 100 randomly selected people wearing body cams?
I'm on the radio, so no one can see me cross my fingers, but fingers crossed. I mean, we're hopeful that that's the case. And there are some procedures and policies that we asked to be in place that haven't been implemented, and we're still pushing for those.
Okay. Well, we're speaking with Carl Williams. He's staff attorney for the ACLU of Massachusetts. We were just talking about the latest in the rollout of the pilot body cam program for the Boston Police Department. Carl, stick with us because there's another law and order story that sort of unfolded recently in Massachusetts that I'd love your view on. but I want to get some background on it first. Now, this story happened last month on Martha's Vineyard. And what happened was this. State police raided yards on the island and confiscated almost 400 marijuana plants. A National Guard helicopter was used to spot the plants from the sky, and then Massachusetts state police officers were dispatched to seize the marijuana. Now, there are reports of destruction of property during the seizures, and lots of people are raising questions about whether a search warrant should have been issued before the raids and whether the National Guard should have been involved in what was a state-level law enforcement action. So joining us now from Vineyard Haven is Barry Stringfellow. He's been reporting on the story for the Martha Vineyard Times, and he's been reporting about it on the raid since last month. Welcome to Radio Boston, Barry.
Thank you, Magna.
So first of all, give us a little bit of some more details on exactly what happened. What was the scale and the scope of this operation?
Well, it was a two-day period, and over those 2 days, a helicopter, a black helicopter, was hovering over the island in different places. And it was something that used to happen here every August, and they'd stopped doing it for a while, and there was some confusion about who was behind all this. But basically what came to me was a story of an 81-year-old man who actually started growing it for his wife when she had pancreatic cancer, and he just, you know, raved about the medical benefits that she had. And so he had four plants in his yard, and all of a sudden these people came in with orange vests, no identification, and just came in and tore out his plants. So that's what got us looking into it. And, you know, we found something like 31 people. People are kind of reluctant to go on the record because most of them said they still want to grow. And these are all, you know, for personal use. But as we looked into it, you know, the local police weren't even clued into this. So it was confusing who was behind it, and eventually found out it was the state police, as you said.
Yeah.
Defensive support from the Air National Guard. And we still don't know quite yet who ordered it within the state police, but it left a lot of people here very upset, and social media really lit up about it. And I have to say, you know, it's one of the most commented stories we have, and it's probably the only time we've had a story where everybody agreed. People are outraged about the expense and about the intrusion. No badges were shown, no warrants, and like you said about property damage, pots were broken and hoses were slashed, which I asked the police about, and they said destruction of property was not part of the instructions. But
Barry, let me just jump in here for a second, because you said something there I want to be sure that we all caught. So for according to everyone that you spoke with whose plants were seized, no one said that any of the officers showed them a badge or a warrant.
Correct.
Okay. And were these officers, they were clearly on people's properties. Were they inside of people's houses?
No, it was all outdoors. And they were spotting, you know, they were spotting from the helicopter, and then they would have ground officers come in and tear it out. And they spent 2 days doing this. And, you know, besides, one woman said she was gardening, and there was a helicopter just hovering over her for a long time. She said it was really unsettling. But then another woman said that, you know, she's a tenant on a property, and these people came in, and she said she was scared to death.
Wow.
She didn't know what to do.
And did anyone say that the officers, who it sounds like they were in plain clothes but with orange vests, that, did they ask anyone that you talked to for a medical use of marijuana ID card?
No, they did not. And finally, I found someone who does have a medical card, and interestingly, another octogenarian. But I'm following up with him now, and actually, it'd be a good thing I speak with Carl. Actually, Carl, I called Whitney Taylor, and she said, political director of the ACLU, and she said they wouldn't get involved unless somebody was arrested, which nobody was arrested. So we were hoping to get some legal advice, or, you know, whether they needed a warrant,
right?
Whether they needed to show some kind of badge.
Well, Barry, on that note, I'm going to turn back to Carl, but that's Barry Stringfellow, reporter for Martha's Vineyard Times, joining us from Vineyard Haven. Thank you so much, Barry.
You're welcome.
Well, as we mentioned, we've got Carl Williams of the ACLU of Massachusetts here. Let's pick up where Barry left off. I mean, should officers have asked for medical use cards?
So first, I want to thank Barry for his work. It's an amazing story. maybe zooming out a little bit,
yeah.
I think the important, one of the really important things here, and I think the reason why social media and everyone who hears the story thinks it's outrageous, is there's a trend in this country in relation to the war on drugs and to the use of marijuana. People don't think marijuana, in general, people in the United States don't think marijuana should be criminalized. And so the idea that, you know, a paramilitary force or a police department, state police, with the help of the National Guard would go in is, I think, to people, a lot of people, terrifying. As to the warrant, specifically, and as to should people be showing badges, certainly they should be showing badges. It's dangerous, right, to go on someone's property, especially the more rural areas. I think you go, someone is like, what on earth are you doing? Like, no one ever comes on my property. So it's just dangerous policing in the first. In the second, if people have the requisite suspicion to believe someone is breaking the law, and that, and you can see that in a place that there isn't a reasonable expectation of privacy,
uh-huh.
right? So if I have machine guns in my backyard and it's just an open backyard, the police can say, well, that looks like you're probably breaking the law. We can go and look at that. In this case, it sounds like, right, if we accept the fact that it's sensible to use the National Guard to do this and the state and state police resources to do this, flying over, and I'm questioning how they exactly did this and how much resources they expended doing this, because a plane wouldn't normally be able to identify marijuana unless people were using some binoculars or some other things. But once they identify that, then they can say, look, this probably is a violation of the law, because the number of plants would seem, from my understanding of it, mm-hmm. if someone has. It's questionable, because you can use enough for, you can have grow enough if you have a certificate for, my understanding, 60 days.
Right.
Which is very questionable how many plants that is.
Well, so let me just jump in here, because we actually spoke to state police, Massachusetts state police spokesperson, Dave Procopio, about this question of how the plants were identified in people's yards and whether there were search warrants issued for this latest operation. He said there were no search warrants issued. Because visual identification from a helicopter, that National Guard helicopter, he says, is enough for probable cause. Here he is.
The unit does occasionally obtain search warrants if the facts and circumstances indicate that further probable cause is required to be obtained through a warrant. But for this operation and for many of the marijuana eradication operations, because they're dealing with outdoor grow sites, the probable cause is obtained through visual observation from a train spotter.
So probable grow sites, I would just say it's an 80-year-old's garden. But I think what's happening here, even the language, it sounds like it's a military operation, right?
Yeah.
And I think it looked a little bit like a military operation.
I mean, they were using equipment from the National Guard.
Right. And I think, so just another trend. So I said about the trend of marijuana and the war on drugs in general is going to much more decriminalization. The public attitudes towards the militarization of police is going also in that direction, saying the police are getting more militarized, people are more resistant to that. So doing something like this seems directly against the will of what people want in this country, right, left, and center.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more from what Dave Procopio, again, a spokesperson for the Massachusetts State Police, says about that, because we did ask him about how frequently the state police uses helicopters from the National Guard in these marijuana search operations, like the one that they executed on the vineyard last month, and here's what he said.
The National Guard was not called in just for this operation. They partner with us on a marijuana eradication program, as they have for many years. We utilize their Black Hawk helicopters and their air crews to help our spotters look for marijuana grows, outdoor marijuana grows, all over the state.
So, Carl Williams, though, this raises a couple questions for me. One is, should is maybe the wrong way to phrase it, but you know, what laws can the National Guard be legally asked to enforce, and especially in a state like Massachusetts, where our state-level laws regarding medical use of marijuana and the decriminalization of the possession of certain amounts of marijuana differ from federal law? I mean, isn't there a tension here for using federal assets or equipment and personnel to execute a state-level search?
So state National Guard are a little bit in the middle of that. So
okay.
the governor and the president have authority.
Over
right?
the National Guard, right?
Yes, and frequently National Guards are deputized, right? basically, I don't know, they do it with a sword, right? I don't think really, but they say, you know, you can enforce whatever it is, right? Whether it's Katrina, a natural disaster.
Emergency operation,
right? Or it can be a law enforcement operation also. I'm assuming that that happened, right? And I'm not sure the physical process that takes, but that's what they were doing in this. Or they were just assisting the flight and they weren't actually doing law enforcement operations, right? They just took someone for a ride, essentially. So they're not actually enforcing the law. They're transportation in that.
Okay.
But really the question that you asked, Magna, is the kids have a meme on the internet. It's why though? Like, why are they doing this? And it seems to go against everything that we're looking for in law enforcement. It's everything we're looking for in relation to the war on drugs. And the understanding that's getting common that drug use, more serious drug use, is a health problem, not a if that, even with marijuana, then it is a criminal justice problem, right? And I think this has really unnerved people in Martha's Vineyard in the state.
Well, Carl Williams is a staff attorney at the ACLU of Massachusetts. He came along with us today to talk about two law enforcement stories about the pilot program of body cams for Boston Police and this interesting marijuana operation that happened on Martha's Vineyard last month. Carl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. And immigrants with jokes about lynching and genocide. The incident stunned much of the Wellesley community, and Green, too, was shocked, but she wasn't entirely surprised. In fact, the incident brought to mind something else that happened to her back in 2011, a moment that first raised her awareness of the challenges of raising her African-American children in a community like Wellesley. Green is an assistant professor of art history at Wellesley College and a contributor to WBUR's Ideas and Opinion page, Cognoscenti. And that's where she first shared her story, but she joins us now. She happens to be in Tampa, Florida today. Nikki Green, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We were really taken by your story and your column on Cognoscenti, and we wanted to invite you here to sort of share it with us once again, and we want to dig in a little deeper. So for people who haven't read it, can you just take us back to 2011 and tell us a little bit about what happened to you and your family?
Sure. So I arrived in Wellesley August of 2011, and so by September, I was settling into a routine, and I joined a colleague and her two children for a stroll through town, the center of town, and we decided to get ice cream with our children. And we were sitting outside on a single bench and eating our ice cream. Very innocently, a woman came, approached us, as happens occasionally when you have cute children. started playing with one of the baby's feet. And my daughter, I was sitting on the bench, and my daughter was standing looking at me. And the woman is an older woman. She then said, "Oh, I want to see her face." And my daughter didn't respond. She's eating her ice cream. She's looking at her mother. And when she didn't respond, she repeated herself. She put her hand on top of her head. She was four at the time. She put her hand on top of her head and turned her head so that it would pivot to look behind her, to look into her face.
So the woman put her hand on your daughter's head.
The woman put her hand on my daughter's head and turned her head physically to make sure that she could see her face straight on. So I was shocked. And my friend who was with me was also shocked. And you know, she said, I don't remember the rest of the conversation because I was so taken aback by that. She eventually walked away after a few seconds and we looked at each other and I turned to her and I said, "Oh my God, when did we become the petting zoo?" Because I hadn't ever had something that drastic happen before. And I know for some people who have read the story, they think, "Oh, no, that's just something people do when they see cute children."
Mm-hmm.
And there's something particularly different about being a group of African-American people, two families, sitting in a predominantly white town and having someone approach you and do that same act, it's absolutely different.
Yeah, so tell me more about that, because I mean, I'm hearing this as a woman and a mother myself. And first of all,
right.
There's just the sheer audacity of someone touching your child without your permission.
Right, exactly.
But second of all, I'd love to hear more from you about why at that moment, again, you said it's just different for you being, you know, a person of color in a predominantly white town. Why did it feel distinctly different?
It was different because in one respect, I should mention, I've lived in predominantly white towns before. I went to boarding school. I'm used to being in these kinds of spaces, right? So it was different because I think in hindsight, and I recorded this instance of this ice cream incident to myself 4 years ago. I wrote this story down because I wanted to hold on to it. It was different because in hindsight, I realized that as I've lived there for the last 5 years, that it is unusual, actually, to see, you know, 6 African-Americans in the main street. So that kind of the way in which Black bodies, in particular, people of color, stand out in the town of Wellesley, I understand now that it was unusual. And so I think the kind of privilege, the kind of white privilege that's been given historically for people to have that sense of entitlement to touch, to manipulate, to even if they think that it's innocent, it is a form of microaggression. This idea that you can have these small acts that don't seem like a big deal, but that over time you realize you've crossed a boundary. This woman crossed a boundary at a certain point. And so I am, you know, I'm speaking as a mother, I'm speaking as a scholar, and I'm also speaking as an African-American woman. Mm-hmm. I teach race, and I actually have a seminar called The Body, Race, and Gender in Modern and Contemporary Art, because I'm clearly aware of these, the way in which systems over time and the history in this country of Black bodies entering these spaces, that there's always going to be a line that's crossed,
yeah,
especially when you don't know the person.
You know, I'm fully cognizant that we are having this conversation in a country much of whose history is founded on white ownership of Black bodies, right?
Exactly.
So
right.
I'm cognizant of that as an important part background to this conversation. But when you talked about microaggressions, I'm wondering, When it comes to the white person crossing that line through a microaggression, if the intent isn't, you know, in 2011 or 2016, you know, in modern times, if the intent isn't one of active conscious racism, should
right.
we really be calling it an aggression, micro or otherwise?
Yes. Just because someone acts in ignorance doesn't make it excusable. And I think it's a process of education that's required so that even if the offender doesn't know that they're perpetuating a kind of act that can be seen as innocent, but over time, for those who are victimized by microaggressions, it can come across as quite violent. And I know that even saying that out loud may make people kind of shudder that how is this innocent interaction, so-called innocent interaction, considered violent? The issue for me and for my children and for so many families in this country is that you can have an instance like that once and may think, oh, that's pretty innocent. But when you see a pattern form over time, how many times will my children be fondled before you say that it's no longer violent? If one person sees it as innocent, and then the 10th person comes around, and my daughter, who's now 9, how many times will she encounter that? At what point is there a limit where she can stake a claim in her own and sort of the ownership of her own body and say, no, you've crossed a line that shouldn't be crossed.
Yeah, you know, so the physical aspect of what happened is It stands out. It does stand right. out to me. And I want to just share with you for a second where I'm coming from because,
sure.
You know, I myself am speaking to as a woman of color myself. And
right.
I grew up in a small town in Oregon that was predominantly white. It was like very much like Wellesley, actually.
Okay,
and
okay.
no one ever really like reached out and grabbed my head, to be honest. But growing up, frequently, you know, people would say, you know, the whole, where are you from? How do you pronounce your name?
Where are you really from?
Where are you really from? Oh, and wow, you don't have an accent. Where did you learn English? All that kind of stuff. And my answers were, right. well, I'm from, you know, Oregon, and I don't have an accent because I'm an American, blah, 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 blah. And right. The point being is, like, those could also be classified as microaggressions. And especially I hear you when you say that the continual nature of it, like year after year, you know, decade after decade. But on the other hand, and again, I'm saying this knowing that, like, telling you, no one ever actually, like, crossed the line and touched me in a weird, uncomfortable way.
Right.
But when it comes to harm, I have to think to myself sometimes, and I question whether or not I was ever harmed by those questions and that those presumptions about who I am. And again, for me, Meghna, I don't necessarily think I was harmed, but it sounds like in your case you're saying that do you feel that where does the sense of harm does a sense of harm come in over time?
It's over time. Was my daughter traumatized by this incident? No. Does she even remember it? Of course not. The issue becomes that for so many, it's the recognition. I'm going to speak from the perspective of my kids.
Mm-hmm.
I want my kids to be self-possessed enough to know that they can recognize what can be a very innocent question. My children are going to have questions about the color of their skin and the texture of their hair, and where, you know, where are your parents from? My husband is actually an immigrant. He's originally from Trinidad. And they're going to have these questions posed. And I do think there is a respectful way to have those questions answered, and that we should all feel welcome to have, you know, if you're curious about another culture or another person's background, it's sure you want that dialogue to happen. That is actually how we learn from each other. I think for me, and I'll bring this back to Wellesley, Massachusetts. I brought up that instance in the context of Wellesley because we had young people who are not, people who are not adults yet, adolescents, who are at a point where they feel as if it's perfectly fine to call people the N-word, even in jest among each other, to talk about genocide, about their classmates and the people in their community, regardless if they were bused in from the Medco program or if they live within this community, then there's something particularly upsetting about living in a town where you can have children be so self-possessed at already such an early age to believe that it's perfectly fine that you can joke like that within a group of friends and have no one check you.
Mm-hmm.
So why I originally wrote that post was because I felt like I needed to state that some small acts occur way before they enter high school. And or also thinking about who are the parents of these children, who are the grandparents of these children, and what kind of conversations are happening in the home that leads to this kind of racist conversation,
right? So
this kind of prejudice. So it's one thing to innocently speak about, you know, finding out about someone's background, and I think that's healthy. It's healthy for in some respects for a child to be able to talk about where are you from, what's your background, and say that with pride. But when denigration becomes a part of the dialogue, I also want my children to understand that they have a right to stand up for themselves.
I hear you saying that it's maybe fewer steps than we think from mm-hmm. an innocent, quote unquote, innocent interaction to setting an example that leads to the kind of racist language that was on those Wellesley High School Facebook posts.
Exactly.
Well, we've just got a couple seconds left. I mean, that's a sobering thought, and I'm grateful for you for sharing that. We just really have just about a minute to go here, Professor
Sure.
Green. Can I ask how your kids are doing? I mean, how has spending the last 5 years as members of the Wellesley community been for them?
Sure, they're fine. They are happy children. They have a great group of friends. Being a part of the Wellesley College community has been very empowering. They have great friends at the school. And I just recently talked with the principal and of their school in Wellesley. I'm very much looking forward to the new school year to have opportunities for the rest of the community to talk, especially parents, so that we can continue to think about how we can build community that is supportive, open-minded, open-hearted, and so that we can make some critical next steps as a community.
Well, Nikki Green is Assistant Professor of Art History at Wellesley College. She teaches and writes about race, feminism, and music in modern and contemporary art. She's also a contributor to Cognoscenti, WBUR's ideas and opinion page. And her most recent Cognoscenti column was titled Eating Ice Cream While Black. We have a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Green, thank you so much for coming on the program and for talking with me. I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And listeners, let us know what you think. Send us your comments at radioboston.org. You can always send us a tweet as well at Radio Boston. We'd love to know what you think. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We want to take a moment now to remember a singular voice in American journalism and politics.
From Washington, the McLaughlin Group, the American original. For over three decades, the sharpest minds, best sources, hardest talk.
That's the unmistakable lead-in to the long-running politics slugfest, the McLaughlin Group. John McLaughlin died yesterday. He was 89, and he hosted his eponymous talk show for 34 years. And in all that time, he missed only one taping just last weekend. Billed the American original, John McLaughlin was just that, contentious, irascible. He ushered in the era of television opinion journalism, and it was all wrapped up in a zinging turn of phrase and steamrolling hosting style. Here he is back in 2008.
On a doomsday scale of 0 to 10, 0 meaning zero doom, 10 meaning absolute metaphysical doom, a total wipeout, annihilation, nothing remaining. How much doom does Hillary face in the November
election?
The
problem is pejorative terms.
Even Democrats don't use it. They use progressive.
And that goes on. And on and on and on. Now, critics loved to tut-tut McLaughlin for turning politics into televisual entertainment, to which John McLaughlin himself responded in 1986 with the characteristic growl, saying, "The acquisition of knowledge need not be like listening to the Gregorian chant." Interesting reference. The Providence, Rhode Island-born McLaughlin was a Jesuit priest early in life, and he studied seminary in Massachusetts and earned master's degrees at Boston College. And in 1970, he launched an unsuccessful Republican campaign for senator in the Ocean State. But McLaughlin left a lasting mark on the culture. For years, no one less than Dana Carvey impersonated him on a recurring Saturday Night Live sketch.
Wrong on a scale of 14 to 32, 14 being absolute metaphysical certitude, and 32 being fairly likely, what are the chances of Golby breaking ranks? Cha-cha-mon!
Wait, 14 to 32?
Wrong, Maltone!
21?
Wrong! The correct answer is 19.24. You were close, Maltone. Next issue!
I've heard that tape 10 times today. It still makes me laugh. That's SNL's Dana Carvey there, helping us remember the American original, John McLaughlin, who died yesterday at the age of 89.
And it will introduce democratic freedoms. Bye-bye.
All right, let's head over to Rio to check in on the Olympics. Shira Springer, the Boston Globe's Olympic columnist, joins us from Rio. Good to have you back, Shira.
Good to be on.
Okay, so first of all, let's talk about how well some of our local athletes have done. Let's listen to what happened to Jevy Stone. She's a Newton native and a graduate of Tufts Medical School. When she competed in women's single sculls, that's rowing, here's the tape of Stone's finish, courtesy of NBC.
Stone is in silver medal spot at the moment. Australia wins gold. Team USA wins silver. Dr. Jevy Stone has done it. The first medal here at the rowing venue, the Lagoa Stadium for Team USA in these 2016 games.
So a silver medal for Dr. Jevy Stone, as I should say. What was that like?
It was amazing. I happened to be at the lagoon when she got silver. She really didn't expect to have a medal in hand when she left Rio. And it's also a bit surprising for her to even be in singles. This was someone who didn't make the 2008 Olympic team in the quad and then sort of went to singles, made the 2012 Olympic team, and thought that would be it for her. But some coaches came up to her father at the London Olympics and said, you know what? She may have a chance at a medal in Rio if she keeps going. And so she thought, okay, maybe I can balance medical school and training for the Olympics. And what I thought was really neat, though, about her post-race comments was the fact that she credited the Charles River for her win. And you're saying, what? How does that happen?
I'm going to guess all that chop on the river.
Exactly. So she was well prepared, much better prepared than many of her competitors who like to row in pristine flat water.
Excellent. Now, Shira, I know you are a very, very committed runner. So let's talk about Shalane Flanagan of Marblehead and the women's marathon. What happened there?
Yeah, Shalane Flanagan placed sixth overall in the marathon. It was an extraordinarily hot and very, very sunny day. And the course that she was running on had very, very little shade. So she was quite pleased with her performance, also in light of the fact that when she ran in the U.S. Olympic trials in February, she really suffered with the heat. So sixth place, something to be proud of. Wish she could have come home with a medal, but she is signed up for Boston next April, so maybe we'll see if she can have a top three or perhaps win there.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about much shorter distances now and a moment which the world is still talking about. Here it is.
Bolt stretching out now. He's coming after him. He's immortal now. Usain's done it. 9.80 all the way from Beijing to London and now to Rio.
That tape, of course, courtesy of NBC, and it is Usain Bolt winning gold in the men's 100 meters. You were at Olympic Stadium when that happened. What was the atmosphere like?
Electric. It really is always electric when Usain Bolt races. I mean, nobody does it better in terms of not only winning the race in convincing fashion, he even seemed to let up a little bit, maybe a few strides from the end, and turn to the camera and smile before he actually crossed the finish line. He always knows where the cameras are. Nobody does it better in terms of the style with which they win races and then the way in which they celebrate. And it was a good 25 or 30 minute post-race celebration from Bolt. He was mugging for every camera, posing with the Olympic mascot, jumping into the stands and posing for selfies with Jamaican fans. I mean, this is going to be his last Olympics, and he is just going to enjoy every moment of it. And that was clear. And I'm looking forward to watching him tomorrow in the final of the 200 meters.
Now, Shira, I heard that Usain Bolt was saying that one of the reasons why he ran a 9.8 and maybe not faster than that is because there was very little time between the semifinal and the final of the men's 100. I mean, how important was that?
Yeah, I think it was very important. I mean, he actually went so far as to say in his post-race comments that the condensed schedule was both ridiculous and stupid, and he didn't know who would schedule it that way. He was quite disappointed because I think he looked in the semifinal like he might be in close to world record shape, like he could pull something like that off, but it just didn't materialize. I wouldn't say 9.8 is pedestrian by any stretch, but I think he had hopes of running faster and in some ways putting on an even bigger show for the fans there.
Well, Shira, we keep introducing you as our woman on the ground in Rio, so I do want to get a little sense to you about what it's like being on the ground there. I mean, One of the major areas of concern leading up to the Rio Games was a lack of adequate transportation infrastructure to support the tens of thousands of people coming to Rio for the Olympics. Have you had any difficulty getting around?
Yes, lots. You know, it's a daily challenge. You kind of never know what buses are going to show up, when they're going to show up. For some athletes, it was the case, you don't know where those buses are going to take you. There were actually a bunch of swimmers who were driven to the Olympic Stadium where track and field takes place instead of the aquatic center where they would be swimming. And they actually had to delay the heats of their races because of that.
Wow.
For me, I got stuck out at the women's marathon, and it was very clear that no bus was coming soon. So I hopped in a cab with a bunch of colleagues, a bus yesterday afternoon that it was going to take to team handball never showed up. So I ended up just walking, you know, 2 miles to the venue. So you kind of just make do. And when the bus doesn't show up, you figure out other means of transportation. It's all part of the experience here in Rio, and you just have to embrace it for what it is.
I wonder how many Rio natives would say that navigating the streets of their great city should be an Olympic event in and of itself.
Well, kind of is.
Shira Springer is the Boston Globe's Olympic columnist. She's our woman on the ground in Rio. Shira, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Okay, finally today, we've got one more Olympics-related story for you, sort of. This one with an ancient Greek twist.
I've always been a lover of Greek mythology, and I thought it would be pretty interesting to swim Messina, especially since it has a pretty big part in Odyssey.
Meet 11-year-old Bostonian Tancred Roy. The Odyssey he's referring to is, of course, Homer's epic. And Messina, the Strait of Messina, a 2-mile stretch of water between Italy and Sicily, crossed by Odysseus when Homer spun his grand myth sometime between the 7th and 8th century BCE, and crossed by young Tancred just last month.
You were just staring at almost this vast expanse of a bluish black. You can see little movements of, like, jellyfish and other sorts of marine life.
But note, Odysseus had a boat. Our young hero swam.
In the beginning, I was like, oh yeah, it's like a normal swim. But as I got further and further along, Messina proved to have its own challenges.
Now, to be honest, I was half hoping to hear Tancred tell us that he battled both the Scylla and Charybdis. But alas, no six-headed, sharp-toothed beasts or monster whirlpools on this swim. Tancred's father, Stephen Roy, who was alongside his son for the crossing, says the challenges were less fantastical, but even more dangerous.
There were a lot of big fish in the water. My biggest concern was sharks.
Sharks, strong currents, and other obstacles to avoid.
There are big ships going through the straits. I mean, like huge tankers and other ships, right? You know, big, huge container ships.
Tancred was undaunted. He'd been preparing for the event for 2 years.
He swam mornings at 6 o'clock at the MIT pool, so it required him to get up at 5:30 and pull himself together, and he would swim for an hour and then go off to school.
Tancred also trained in Boston Harbor.
For a lot of my training, I swam along the shore in Pleasure Bay, which wasn't more than maybe 15, 20 feet deep. And going from 15, 20 feet to 300 to 400 feet is a huge difference.
Not to mention the fact that Boston Harbor is about 20 degrees colder than the water in the Strait of Messina. But all that training paid off. Tancred crossed Messina in just 1 hour and 7 minutes. I'm not sure Homer told us how long it took Odysseus to make the same journey. Classic scholars listening, please do let us know. But I'm going to guess it wasn't in just over an hour. And as if Tancred's feat weren't already impressive enough, his father Stephen added this about his family.
Well, I don't think anyone could swim more than 25 yards in a pool.
And that was just 2 years ago. But the thing his dad is proudest of, not so much Tancred's physical feat, but...
It's one thing to read about Greek myths. It's another thing to actually go to the place where the Greek myth took place and to interact, you know, to get involved in a proactive basis and do something that's unusual.
So we come to the end of this chapter of Tancred's journey. However, as with any grand epic, Stephen says there is some foreshadowing of what may come next for his son.
Yeah, his name is Tancred Britannicus Roy. So he was born with a classic middle name, all right? So maybe that was also a spur doing something, but he won't be swimming the English Channel next year, I don't think.
Tancred, in fact, is looking further east.
I have had my eye on something called the Straits of Bonifacio. It's an 8-mile-long swim, though there aren't any currents. So it should be an interesting experience, though I'm not sure I want to do it or not.
That's 11-year-old, yes, 11-year-old Tancred Roy. He swam across the Strait of Messina just last month. Now, with that as inspiration for you, we bid you the best of adventures for the rest of this Wednesday afternoon. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.